KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Folsom, California.
Noe Valley.
Village in the Park in Daly City.
Potrero Hill.
Glen Park.
South Beach.
I live in Bernal Heights.
Coming up, we'll talk to advocates for a Daly City man who they say was unlawfully transferred by police to ICE custody.
Their community is 50% immigrant, so the stakes are high in terms of whether or not Daly City police are willing to take themselves out of the immigration business.
Then a look inside the California Condor Recovery Program in Oakland.
You see this thing that makes this big shadow come over, and there's just nothing like it.
And we go looking for exotic animals right here in San Francisco's Glen Canyon.
Rhesus monkeys, cudgel monkeys, white monkeys, rat-tail monkeys, pigtail monkeys.
But are they there? Stay tuned. Cross Currents is coming up. Since the start of August, activists have been protesting in front of San Francisco's ICE headquarters as part of a month-long series of protests, part of what they're calling the Month of Momentum, shedding light on ICE raids that happen in cities across the country. Just to the south of San Francisco, immigrant advocates filed a complaint last week against Daly City, claiming the police there wrongfully handed over a man, Jose Armando Escobar Lopez, to ICE after a traffic stop. The group Asian Americans Advancing Justice, part of the Asian Law Caucus, filed a complaint with Daly City, claiming it breached SB 54, the California Values Act. It prohibits police from sharing immigration information with ICE. The city says it was an isolated incident, and they're reviewing their internal processes. Advocates say that's not enough. Meanwhile, Armando is still in ICE custody in Bakersfield, awaiting possible deportation. Angela Chan is with the Asian Law Caucus. I called her up to hear more about the case and what it means.
On May 11th this year, Armando and his girlfriend, Christia, and Christia's younger brother were driving back from a church event, actually a baptism, and Christia was tired, so she asked Armando to drive. And as they were almost home in San Francisco where they reside, they were stopped by a Daly City police officer. The police officer did not explain why he stopped Armando. Christia asked multiple times why he was stopping them, and the officer did not explain why, never issued any sort of traffic citation or otherwise, and then proceeded to ask Armando for his driver's license. When Armando couldn't respond to him because Armando does not speak English, the officer started getting angry. They asked if he was an immigrant, and then the officer started doing an immigration background check by going back to his patrol car and checking to see if Armando has any sort of prior immigration history. The officer found a civil immigration warrant, which is a warrant that is actually not a real warrant. It's a piece of paper that's signed by an ICE agent and not by a judge. It's not based on any sort of probable cause finding. The officer then went back to Armando, arrested him, and took him back to the police station. During that time, the officer contacted ICE and coordinated with an ICE agent to meet him and Armando at the police station.
And Angela, if we can just unpack this just a little bit, just to understand, what was the illegal part of this? At what point?
Oh, so many.
Do you think?
Just off the top of my head, some of the violations of SB 4, which is a California state sanctuary law that was passed in 2017, went into effect in January 2018, that limits and prohibits many law enforcement activities with ICE. The Daly City police stopped him. They also asked him about his immigration status. They're not allowed to ask about immigration status under SB 4. They also responded to a civil immigration warrant. They're prohibited from doing so under SB 4. They also notified ICE, which they're prohibited from doing under SB 4. They provided his personal information to ICE, including his name, his physical description. They were able to obtain his parents' names. They shared this personal information with ICE, which also is in violation of SB 54. And then they took him back to the police station and arrested him. They're not allowed to arrest people for immigration purposes, which is what they did.
But on July 22nd, the city of Daly City passed a resolution addressing this. And so what are you saying about that then?
So that, I think that's a part of their campaign to construct their image as being pro-immigrant. A reflection of the meeting that we had with them, where they are saying nice things that are lovely to hear about immigrants and how much they care about immigrants, but it's symbolic. A resolution has no binding impact. It's not a policy. It doesn't change the really deeply flawed Daly City Police Department policy with respect to immigrants. So that's the problem.
And what are you asking for, you and the other organizations partnering with you?
Yeah, what we're asking for is the Daly City police or Daly City officials to take this matter seriously. It's not an issue of your public image. It's not an issue of making it look like you care about immigrants. It's an issue of actually doing something to assist Armando, who is still detained, who's still fighting his deportation case, who was almost deported 2 weeks ago to El Salvador, a country where he doesn't have his close family members. He doesn't have his community, a country that he left when he was a minor. And so that's something that they could do. They could sign a U visa certification. They could provide him with money damages for everything they put him through. They also could adopt the model policy that we already drafted and gave to them that would automatically change their procedure for how their officers interact with ICE, you know, clearly prohibiting any communication or interaction with ICE. And they can retrain their officers on that policy.
And Angela, this is one story. I'm wondering, in your work, are you finding more and more cases like this? And is it getting to be more of an issue in light of the current political climate?
So SB 54 has had a good impact, but there are also continual challenges. We did a statewide study of the impact of SB 54 by issuing public records requests to all sheriff's departments, all 58, and all police departments. And then we analyzed 169 responses that we've received back. And we found that, unfortunately, about 40% of these agencies have policies that do not comply with SB 54 or do not fully comply. So that's the challenge that lays ahead, is to make sure that we make it clear to these law enforcement agencies that SB 54 is binding law and they will be subject to liability if they don't comply. And there's harm to the immigrant community when they are not following our immigrant rights laws in good faith. And the other piece is that SB 54 has had a major impact. In the first 5 months of implementation of SB 54, from January until May 2018, compared to the prior 5 months, there was a 40% decrease in ICE arrests in local jails. And that overall, there's a 25% decrease in ICE arrests in all of California, in and outside of our jails. And the decrease in ICE arrests in jails accounted for about half of that overall decrease. So it's been a significant change since even the beginning points of implementation of SB 54. And our concern is to make sure that we maximize the impact, right? 40% is the start, but if we make sure that every single law enforcement agency complies with SB 54 in good faith, then it's very foreseeable that there'll be a more significant decrease on top of that.
And what's next now in the case of Daly City?
We'll wait to see what their response is with respect to our government claim. They could respond and say they want to work with us, or they could say we don't want to work with you. And then in that case, we'd have to litigate this matter. We are prioritizing this case, and we'll do everything we can to make sure that we help Armando and that Daly City adopts the model policy that separates their local police from ICE. Another reason why we're focused on Daly City is that their community is 50% immigrant. It's Asian and Latino, primarily the immigrant population there. So the stakes are high in terms of whether or not Daly City Police are willing to comply with SB 54 and willing to take themselves out of the immigration business. So we'll be focused on Daly City and pushing them to help Armando and to adopt a policy change until they give up, basically, and actually want to work with us.
That's Angela Chan with the Asian Law Caucus. Find more immigration reporting at kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. This is the sound of the California condor. a once severely endangered bird. They went extinct in the wild, and the number of birds in captivity was as low as 27. The process of trying to protect and regenerate the condor population began in the early 1900s. Since then, government agencies have spent $20 million on the conservation effort, making it one of the most expensive in U.S. history. Now, wildlife biologists have something to celebrate. The 1,000th chick has hatched in a recovery program that started in the 1980s. The Oakland Zoo participates in that program, and a few years ago, when they were first getting started, reporter Alyssa Kapnick went to find out what they do there.
So we're passing lions right now. And we're coming up on our aviary right here.
Don't run into people, Brock.
Nikki Mora is leading me through the Oakland Zoo. She's the marketing and PR manager here, and she has special access to a hidden part of this animal world.
I don't know how muddy it's going to be down here. We're going to go down this path.
We head behind the zebra exhibit and beyond the elephant barns.
Oh, they have the little sign up. That's kind of cool.
And finally, we've reached our destination. A giant empty cage hidden away from zoo visitors, out of earshot and out of sight.
They put up this mesh right here so that it's kind of a sound barrier and sight barrier outside of the facility so that the birds don't get scared and they're just kind of in their own environment back here.
The cage is about 20 feet square and 10 feet tall, built for the big birds who will eventually land here.
Obviously, we never want to have them here because that means they're sick.
This is Dr. Andrea Goodnight, the associate veterinarian at the zoo. She's been studying condors for years and feels a personal investment in preserving them.
I can tell you the first time that you see a condor in the wild is just a magical experience.
The way she describes it, when the California condor takes flight, it flaps its wings once and then just rides the wind currents for hours at a time. The birds can fly 150 miles at a stretch and as high as 15,000 feet in the air.
I can recount when I was in Pinnacles National Monument hiking with my husband, and I was condor spotting because I knew that they were supposed to be there, and I kept looking. I'd look up and see a big bird, and we'd both point, oh no, it's a vulture. Oh, it's another turkey vulture. Oh, it's a turkey vulture. And then you see this thing that makes this big shadow come over, and you point, and it's like, oh, that's a condor. And there's just nothing like it.
It's a beauty humans have long wanted to capture. Museum collectors used to kill condors for their displays. And it's no wonder. The bird is magnificent. A wingspan of nearly 10 feet and a shock of red skin on its skull. Condors were also hunted for food and their eggs stolen by egg collectors. In the first half of the 20th century, the federal government started trying to preserve the birds. But by the early 1980s, there were only about a dozen wild condors left. By this point, scientists had been studying the bird for years. They acted quickly by literally going out and collecting every single bird they could find and bringing them to breeding sites at the San Diego Wild Animal Park and the Los Angeles Zoo. They found and captured the last known wild condor, whom they called Igor, on Easter Sunday, 1987.
Luckily, these scientists were able to figure out how to breed the birds in captivity, how to release them, how to get them successfully back out in the wild.
Biologists began releasing the condors just 5 years after they'd collected them all. But the birds still aren't totally out of the woods, so to speak. It's illegal to hunt them now, but hunters are still a danger. The condors are scavengers, which means they don't often kill their own food, but rely on eating animals that have already died.
And so what is happening to the birds now is that they're eating carcasses that they find out in the wild that have been shot by hunters or ranchers or poachers at times as well.
Nowadays, the carcasses the condors eat are often animals that were shot and killed by lead bullets. This means that the meat has lead poisoning. And when the condors eat that meat, they get lead poisoning. Death by lead is slow and painful. Lead-poisoned condors have trouble flying and walking and can't protect themselves. They fall off cliffs or starve to death. The problems become so severe that scientists now go out regularly to test the wild condor's blood levels and take them back for treatment if their levels are high. Which brings us back to the Oakland Zoo.
What we do is basically give them a drug that helps pull the lead out of the blood, and then they are able to excrete it through their kidneys.
The process Dr. Goodnight is describing is called chelation. It can take from a week to long months. During that time, the scientists want to make sure that the birds don't get too used to humans so that they'll be ready for release back into the wild as soon as they're cured. This means taking some extreme measures.
Here you can kind of see there's two holding areas, so we could actually treat two sick condors down here.
This is Nikki Mora again.
I would say each side of the holding facility is probably a large of a small living room or sitting area that one might have in their home.
A sitting area with chain link fence walls and no insulation.
In the wild, the birds would not have a heated environment, so they don't want them to get used to special cozy environments.
When the birds arrive, the scientists and vets will be able to monitor them by video 24 hours a day. The zookeepers want as little contact with the birds as possible, so the zoo has designed some special systems.
There's actually a chute. See that chute right there? That's where they're gonna feed the birds.
Moore is pointing to a big black tube sticking out of the cement wall and into the pen. The zookeepers will feed the condors through the chute so that the birds won't think that the food is coming from humans and won't, therefore, become reliant on humans for food. In theory, this will all work perfectly. The condors will get better, they'll be released, and they'll live their lives in the wild. But scientists at other condor rehab centers have already discovered another problem. Once they're released, the birds go right back to finding and eating lead-tainted meat. They're still getting sick. So biologists are trying yet another intervention. Here's Dr. Goodnight again.
The biologists are literally dragging cow carcasses up there, these calves that they get from dairies, stillborn calves. They take them up there. They know that they're non-tainted. They know they don't have any lead in them. And so they supplementally feed the birds. And obviously, this can't continue forever. It's not a self-sustaining population that way.
It's easy to see why scientists thought it was the obvious choice to remove all condors from the wild and bring them in for breeding. Otherwise, they'd disappear forever. It's harder to determine how much and for how long the birds have been changed by human contact. In an open letter from September of 1980, David Brower, founder of the Sierra Club Foundation, wrote the following.
A condor is only 5% feathers, flesh, blood, and bone. The rest is place. Condors are a soaring manifestation of the place that built them and coded their genes. That place requires space to meet in, to teach fledglings to roost unmolested, to bathe and drink in, to find other condors in and not biologists, and to fly over wild and free.
Alyssa Kapnick reported that story in 2013 when the Oakland Zoo first joined the Condor Recovery Program. They still treat condors for lead poisoning, but good news, a statewide ban on lead ammunition used for hunting went into effect July 1st of this year. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanna Baba. Next, we'll hear a story inspired by you. It's a Hay Area short where we find bite-sized answers to the questions you ask. Listener Richard Goldman had a question.
Was there ever a railroad that ran from downtown San Francisco to Glen Canyon? And in Glen Canyon, was there ever an exotic animal park or zoo?
And reporter Jesse Rhodes has the answer.
Back in the 1880s, if you caught the real estate bug and had cash to burn, you might see what Baron Diaz saw. a chance to make more money. Yost bought 200 acres of land in what is now Sunnyside. And to make the land more enticing to buyers, he connected the area to downtown San Francisco with the city's first electric railroad. So to answer your first question, yes, there was a railroad that ran from downtown to Glen Canyon. Enter Archibald S. Baldwin. Baldwin buys land and devises a plan
of developing a pleasuring ground and zoo.
That's Evelyn Rose, founder of the Glen Park Neighborhoods History Project.
Rhesus monkeys, cudge monkeys, white monkeys, rat-tail monkeys.
That's only part of Baldwin's shopping list for the zoo, which was nicknamed the Monkey Ranch. But some financial setbacks and many monkey puns later, the most exotic animals that appear to have made it into the zoo were two emus, a peacock, and a big baboon. So to answer your second question, yes, there was an exotic animal zoo in Glen Canyon. It was there until 1922, when the zoo was sold to the city for about $45,000 and became what we know today as beautiful Glen Canyon. In Glen Park, I'm Jesse Rhodes for Hey Area.
Keeper is very fond of rum. Zebras are reactionaries, antelopes are missionaries. Pigeons plot in secrecy, and hamsters turn on frequently. What the gas? You got to come and see at the zoo.
Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. A new report says we don't need to fear robots taking over our jobs.
Whichever path automation takes, the Bay Area overall is going to be fine. I think the question is, who in the Bay Area is going to be the most fine?
AI and employment tomorrow at 5. This music is by Danny Click and the Hell Yeahs from San Francisco. They're performing at the Mystic Theater in Petaluma this Thursday. Today's Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Audrey Dilling, Sophie Codner, Lisa Morehouse, Adriana Morga, True Quinn, Marissa Ortega Welch, Jocelyn Tabankai, and Eli Wortschafter. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shireen Adil. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.